Welcome to the Cinephile Hiss and Fit Podcast, brought to you by the Ruminations Radio Network and sponsored by Film Obsessive. This is the Tirades Film Movie Debate hosted by two film critics, Cool Dad and Teachers. I'm Don Shanahan.
And I'm someone with whom you I fucked it up. There's a line in this movie, and it's actually grammatically correct, and it's kind of cool. But I always want to say it, and I always fuck it up. It's when Ron Perlman says, you'll find out I'm someone with whom not to fuck. There we go. That's who it is. So I'm William. I am someone with whom not to fuck Johnson.
The rolls off the tongue, William. Off the tongue. Ladies and gentlemen, we're damn glad to have you folks. This is all for tantrum's sake. We're shared passions and high fives wash away any place for hate. No matter what, we encourage you all to love what you love. But for now, the gloves are off and the hissy fit is on. For those of you who are really good at Ron Perlman quotes and didn't look at the title of the episode you clicked on, we're talking about Alien Resurrection to continue the Cinephile Hiss and Fit reevaluation and rewatch or critical reassessment, whatever we're supposed to say about this series that Will loves belovedly, and I'm coming back to just as a guy who hasn't seen him in a long time. Today is 1997's Alien Resurrection. Our format is this, the recommending lever, and it's pretty much the recommender of a guy here. It's going to be Will. He's going to go first with five unearthed minutes to shower his praise and state his high minded case of why this one deserves pantheon place with the first two. The hater, which is I can't say hater, but just the second guy, is going to follow. That's me with 5 and 2 minutes of my own to present any counterpoints or any manner of intellectual scorch earth I've got. After that, we'll open it up for about 30 minutes of shared conversation where the hissy fit really gets chippy. So for this show, let's go.
So a little trivia here, and I'm gonna, you know what, I run the Instagram account for Cinephile Hiss and Fit, and I like
you to sure do
things, and I've posted like some really cool stuff from Alien 3 and Alien Resurrection on here. I wasn't gonna like dilute all the posting with Alien stuff, but I'm gonna do it anyway, because this is one of the two Laserdiscs I still own. It's still unopened. It's beautiful. I look at it every time I record, because it's up next to my Star Trek Generations Laserdisc, and it has the big THX label on it. But I think I'll take some pictures of the artwork on it and just kind of show people that maybe don't even know what a Laserdisc is. But
no kidding.
The reason why I own it on Laserdisc is this movie came out in 97. I was in high school. I would rent Laserdiscs from Laser Video down the street with my dad. And I loved this movie so fucking much that I bought it on Laserdisc. Now, keep in mind, 97, we're talking like DVDs are already starting to come out. So it's right. Not really, this is a dying thing. So the fact that I own, I could be forgiven for buying Star Trek Generations on Laserdisc, because that was 94. Probably the Laserdisc came out 95, but this is 97. This is the DVD era. I should not have Alien Resurrection, yet I do, and I'm staring at it right now, and I love it so much.
What disc set you back, if you could say so?
Oh, back then?
Yeah. Oh,
God. I mean, probably 1999 and 1997 dollars, you know? Like,
Yeah. That's not too bad.
The cost of a movie, you know, like
I didn't know if those things ran like 35, 40, you know, or anything on that level.
Nah, about that point, there was probably a lot of places. I mean, the fact that there was a Laserdisc renting store was still in existence. Right? The fact that they probably would like to get rid of stuff. I didn't buy it from there. I bought it from, I don't even remember where I bought it from, but you know, I'm sure they were kind of like, we got to get rid of this shit real quick. So
right here comes DVD.
I'm sure it wasn't too expensive, but
it's cool. No, but you didn't have to go to eBay and spend collector level money to get that thing. You've had since 97.
I've had both. Yeah, and that's how hardcore of a fan I am.
Nice.
I saw this in the theater. I dragged a couple friends to it, and they were all disturbed by how this movie was, because they were just like, what the hell is this? And I was in love with it, and this is the one of all of them. I would say, even though Aliens is in my top 100, and I equally love this one, Alien and Aliens together, as I've mentioned on other shows, this is probably the one I rewatched the most, just because of its, well, I'll get into it, but this is probably my most rewatched Alien film, because I just love it that much. So
cool. That's where start your five recommending lover.
Okay, I will. Sorry. That's so
no, you're good. Hey,
This is basically like an extended six. This is the special edition of my 5 minutes. I have always loved the Alien movies, mainly because each entry, as I've mentioned last week and in previous shows, is very director heavy. Even though it is a studio franchise, the movies have always, at least in the original four, have done a great job of expanding the mythos without being dominated by it and pushing the envelope on things, trying new things. A lot of the stuff that people complain about now with franchise filmmaking, I guess people were complaining about it when they weren't doing that, because Alien Resurrection is a perfect example of subverting expectations. And it also can be said it's probably one of the weirdest summer blockbusters ever. I mean, it's a fucking weird movie. And I think that's another reason why it kind of hits. I mean, you watch Alien, you got the classic haunted house, you know, creature feature. You know, it's kind of Jaws in space in a haunted house. Aliens is the pulse pounding stuff. You know, it's the action movie. It's got the aliens are less creepy and more just, you know, they're just, you can't overcome them. There's just so many of them and they're crazy. The third one, as we discussed last week, is a incredibly bleak, almost nihilistic film, kind of an epilogue to the Ripley character. Now, instead of this movie coming up with, it's not exactly scientific, but instead of the movie coming up with some weird, convoluted way for Ripley to still be alive, they do an excellent job of like saying, okay, this is Ripley, but it's not Ripley. So you kind of have those expectations out the door. This is kind of a new, Ripley, and it gives Sigourney Weaver some new scenery to chew and some new things to really work on. It gives some freshness to the character. We're not getting to the point that you would sometimes get in franchises where the character's back for the sixth or seventh time and they're just kind of phoning it in. Like, she was given stuff to do in this. And I think that fresh approach of giving us kind of a new but old Ripley, combined with the exquisite direction of Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who adds all kinds of great, crazy influences to this. And the fact that they kind of mix up all the genres of the previous films in this one. There's a lot of hardcore horror in this. There's a lot of action. There's a lot of, I would say, maybe not bleakness, but definitely some off-color, dark aspects to this film in certain parts, especially the scene involving all the prior Ripleys. And then, of course, it's its own weird French movie, too, on top of that. And then, of course, also you get if anyone's a Firefly / Serenity fan out there, you pretty much get the proto Firefly from this movie, because I think this was some of this was floating around Joss Whedon's head. And he was like, hey, I kind of like the idea of this group of space pirates, you know, that speak in weird dialects and have all kinds of weird personalities. I mean, there's a lot of Firefly in this. So if you like that, this was Firefly before Firefly. There's a lot of stuff going on in this movie. It's hard to condense. But frankly, I love everything from the acting to the directing to the cinematography is exquisite. The production design is great. The music, though not on the same level as Alien 3 in terms of its epicness, is excellent. There's just a lot going on here. Lots of, unlike Alien 3, there is CGI, but there's a lot more puppet work in this one, a lot more practical effects. It's just, I'm just rambling at this point, but it's just, for whatever reason, it just really hit me. It always has hit me. Every time I watch it, I think it gets better. And I think that I wish that this version of Ripley got to see more screen time. Unfortunately, she's lost to the sands of time. And it doesn't feel like a fitting end to the Alien quadrilogy. But at the same time, it does feel like a wonderful, unique, weird entry into a already very unique franchise.
Well done, well done, well done. Yeah, this one is, I remember seeing it in 97 because that would be the wheelhouse of me being that, because this was a Thanksgiving release. You're a month before Titanic. I'm a college freshman at that point where I'm seeing everything I can get my hands on. So I remember seeing it and being like, all right, that took some turns. And I probably never watched it since because I was not much of an alien guy before that. But coming back to it now, this was damn fun. It's stupid. But you're right. This is the weirdest, most loosey-goosey alien movie of the bunch I've seen. So that's got a big plus going for it. You've got a super fluidly interesting Ripley version here where she is a little more powerful and can kind of dabble and play with a little bit. Like you said, the Whedon stuff is out here when it comes to ragtag Motley Crue characters that are just fascinating to watch just to see them get killed. And Ron Perlman's obviously a massive big presence. And Winona Ryder at her time was right there in her It Girl wheelhouse. So, this is the weirdest and most fun alien movie of the bunch I've watched. And that's good enough for me for a good bit of this where, I do wonder, cooks in the kitchen. It sounds like it's just Whedon getting credit here. And he's that guy that's gonna just, and we've seen his influences of Cabin in the Woods. We've seen some other thing, obviously his Avengers stuff, which is hit or miss for our guy, the Marvel shill where, and then, yeah, like you said, the proto Firefly stuff is all there when it comes to the ragtag group. I'd rather hang with this crew of Meat Buffet than I would the Prisoners of Alien 3. Anytime you get Dan Hedaya in a movie, just to kill him off in a fun way is great. Kills are fun. The puppet work and, like you said, the makeup and prop design, set design, all that is really on the marks. It's cockamamie because you're like, oh, we're barreling towards Earth. What are we going to do? And it's also the experimentation stuff, the Brad Dourif stuff. You're throwing a lot of things to the wall to see if they stick. Plenty of it does in a good, gooey fashion. But like I said, in Alien 3, you still have the core. You still have Sigourney Weaver putting this movie on her back and carrying what she can carry, getting new flavor and spice that she can kind of apply to this different version of her character, which is the gravitas is still there, the weight of history is still there because we're playing with two centuries of time, but also the let's make her an ass kicker, now give her some means to make her an ass kicker some more. So she's a little bit of MacGyver where she can kind of do a little bit of everything. She can smell them coming, see them coming. Her blood is a very convenient weapon when needed or a tool when needed. But you know what, that's where this, after some of the stagnation of three, that's where this movie kind of needed to go. And when I look back at 97 at just the excessiveness of how we used to do things, like, cause this was a week before, this was like a week, 2 weeks after Starship Troopers. And obviously, like I said, a month before Titanic. And you're the summer of 97 where it's, you know, Twister and Independence Day were before this. The bar is there where you need to make something glossy, popcorn and loud, but then still thrill. Thrill with the kills, thrill with good characters, thrill with exciting things to do, and this movie has that in spades. So it's fun to watch. I gave it the same three I did Alien 3, where I know when I'm watching it's dumb and horrendous and stupid, and by the time we get to the human alien stuff at the end, where I'm like, oh, okay, now we're just puppy dog eye blinking through here. Like, where's this going? But I was in. I had the ride. I had a good time. So yep. All right, folks, let's take a quick break for a short announcement from our non-corporate partners and friends.
What's up, gang? This is Hoptimus. You've been listening to one of the great new podcasts from Ruminations Radio Network. If you want some more tasty sound vibes, come check out my new podcast, The Retro Futurist Culture, where we talk about alternate timelines, cyberpunk, anime, and other crazy worlds. If that does not strike your fancy, we have plenty of other great shows at ruminationsradionetwork.com.
All right, welcome back. Yeah, happy to take this dive and get back in where this was.
Yeah. So just like the last one, there's so many things I want to talk about with this, but the first one we got to throw out, like this, I mean, there's a lot of people in a lot of the other three Alien movies that are, of course, famous in their own ways.
Oh, sure.
But I kind of feel like this is like, this is one of the most stacked casts.
Oh, easily, Alien. Easily.
Even some of the smaller characters, Leland Orser, Raymond Cruz, you got Brad Dourif kissing aliens, Dan Hedaya, Michael Wincott with his amazing voice.
I want him to narrate my life, man. Just,
yeah, you know. Ron Perlman. Like, it's just, this is a fucking great cast, man.
Yeah.
And actually, another thing that I think has aged well also, I thought at the time Winona Ryder was very miscast, but as I watch it now, I actually kind of really appreciate her performance. I actually think it's not that bad.
I think the 18-year-old version of me that saw Winona Ryder in 97 probably was that person who sounds like some millennial today who's like, it took me out of the movie. I admit, 97, the presence of Ryder, and then the denouement or the revealment that she was an android, spoiler alert, for a 26-year-old movie. She was... I didn't get her. I was never really convinced by her back when I saw it in 97. Seeing her now, I'm not a Stranger Things person, so I don't get the... I'm not a, you know, Winona stand for life kind of person, but she can play in this movie. I like that she pushes and forces a lot of the forward momentum of the movie alongside Sigourney, where she's there to go, let's keep going, run down the hall. Like she's pushing, and I appreciate that more now than then. So, yeah, I can, in the reassessment we're doing here, this is, she fits. Could somebody else have done this? Like Mila Jovovich, or like, could, I'm thinking of 97, like this would be Fifth Element level, like where like I'd swap those two. I mean, well, no, because Mila being the foreign beauty that she is helps Fifth Element, where I can't do a straight trade there, but it works.
Well, and I think, well, I'm glad that you don't hate this movie, because I think a lot of people hate this.
I can't.
I think another problem, and this is why no one, as I said at the last show, no one can be happy with anything, because no one was happy with the risks this movie took then, and now everyone wants movies to take risks, because they fit into this mold that everyone demanded. So it's tough for me, but I think one of the main things that I see people complain about is Ripley, and I'm just like, not her performance or anything. She's magnificent as always. Sigourney Weaver is
bringing back the clone version.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it at all, because Sigourney Weaver is such a great actress that she is able to make it a different character while still having elements of the original Ripley to it. But I think, just like people had a problem with Hicks and Newt dying in Alien 3 off screen, I think people were just like, well, this isn't my Ripley. And it's like, well, that's not the point. Like the point, it's not, the point was, they could, it's sci-fi. They could have come up with some crazy thing that she was, you know, the fire, you know, took her to another part of space or some shit, and then she's still alive. But it's very intentional that this isn't the Ripley we know. It's to make us feel kind of out of place. It's hard to surprise Ripley at this point with fucking aliens, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So, like, this kind of puts her at another spot where Ripley, it's a different Ripley. She's got a different emotional aspect to her. She's a different creature altogether. I mean, she's part alien at this point.
Right.
It's supposed to be... those elements are supposed to give her some challenges, because by the end of 3, she's already fought these things so much that she's kind of like, hey, this sounds like a great plan, let's do it. And you know she's going to execute the plan.
Right.
This adds some more stakes to it. It goes like, okay, well, first of all, whose side is she going to be on? And second, like, she's not going to know how to handle this situation. She's hundreds of years out of her element. She's a completely different person. She doesn't have some of her memories. I don't know. I think it's a very deliberate choice to make her not the Ripley from before. And I think it's an excellent choice personally.
I think so too.
I would rather have that than some convoluted way that the Ripley from Alien 3 survived. Yeah. It's stupid. So
yeah, me too. I'm glad the wrinkles they took. I'm glad. I know this. I know probably some people then, and I think they'd be even louder now, would be like, oh, you made her a superhero, you know, because you gave her superpowers and super blood and stuff like that. Like, where I guess on paper that feels like a odd little cop out, even by 1997 terms. But again, when you go back to an ass kicking level of movie, and then the subversive way that you, like you said, that was the word you kind of sold me on before we watched this and got on the show, was just subversive. And so you could make her powerful, you could make her bigger and bolder and all that, like the basketball game thing and stuff like that. Like you can demonstrate some fun there with her, or just some differences with her. But the fun part, like you said, or the good part, is that it's still Sigourney Weaver doing her absolute best just to make any of that compelling. Like when we get to that lab scene where she sees the other versions of her clone, the 1 through 7 before she's 8, like that's what a fucking crusher of a great scene where the badass is there, but then at the same time, like the echo of Ellen Ripley is there, and that's just really cool. And she plays that all the way through. She plays it with toughness, she plays it with grit, she plays it with interest in the character, and it becomes the next springboard for the next action part of the movie. And all those things she can do, I mean, is she given a few Schwarzenegger clunker lines, like who do I need to fuck around here, like probably, you know, but that's but that's 90s for you, and I don't think those things have aged any more different than anything else in the movie, where, again, you have to go, this is an Ellen Ripley, this is ass kicker clone Ripley, and roll with it. And can we still make something that we're chasing and trying to figure out as we go? And that's the fun part, is I went back to my 5 to say it, but just the thrills. Like, this movie has really great kills, really good action, and CGI is obviously a little more cleaned up from 92 to now, and it moves great and looks great.
Yeah, it's actually, yeah, it's, I was kind of surprised when I was watching it, how fast paced it was. I mean, not that I was paying attention to pacing too much in 97, but just watching it now, you know, when you're, I think I watched it on a school night, so I was kind of like, okay, I gotta get this done. Like,
yeah,
it moved really fast and I wanted more. I mean, a lot of people complain about the direction, some of the humors, things like that.
Sure.
I think it's a benefit of the film. It
helps a little something. Yeah.
I think it gives it something because we have seen now.
We just got out of Dower 92. So we went from nihilistic and cold to this, and I'll take the switch.
Right. And you know, but we now have four very different films. And at this point, you have the fourth film, you should be expecting, people should stop expecting like a formula at this point. It's the fourth film. You've got this, you can kind of tell from the beginning that this director's got some weird shit going on. Like I definitely think this is one of the weirdest studio movies ever made. Because I mean, dude, Ripley fucks an alien in this one. Like, it's insane. Like, I mean, if you put that on paper, right?
Oh, God.
You're like, how are we going to get to the climax of this movie, literally, figuratively? They're going to be like, hey, how about Ripley fucks the alien? And it's like, yeah, what? But they do it in this movie. Now, that brings up, because she did some fucking, that brings up another thing that people seem to mostly hate or love. I happen to love it. Is the child monster the I guess 1/5 human and the rest alien white creature? What are your thoughts on this alien baby,
hybrid baby? The final one that gets pulled out the window. I mean, you've gone weird, you know, and you've made this, you've tied enough strings to Ripley 8 to this whole, you know, the queen mother, this is, I'm her mother, you know, like all that, like by the time you've went weird like that. And obviously there's established mini lore that, you know, the aliens take on more of the physical traits of what beast they came out of, you know, like we were saying between dog and ox in Alien 3, where, if you're going to jump some humans, put some personification on it, and birth one, go ahead and go gross and weird. It's it hits the note it wants to hit to be weird. Like I said, I know I call them puppy dog eyes in the thing, but like that it beats the dead-eyed Uncanny Valley stuff we would see in a CGI thing. Like the fact that she interacts with it, the clutches it, and there's stuff going on there. It's a little smarter than the other usual aliens. Like, that's kind of fun. If anything, I probably wish for, I know it's weird and it's overly stuffed at the ending, but like, I would have took half a movie with that creature instead of the last third, you know, make that be your formidable, like, we got to beat that thing who knows us because we're human too. And that would have been a more fun, like, more time with that one would have been fun, but what we get is still impactful for sure. And I read about the creature designs where they were going like, and again, there's your Frenchman for you. Like, they were trying for like genitalia from both genders on there. Like, we're gonna put boobs, a vagina, and a penis and stuff like that. We're like, whoo, all right. If you're going there, phew, go for it. And I'm glad it's off-putting. It's supposed to be disgusting, you know? And they hit the note they're going for.
And as I was putting together an Instagram post for this,
yeah,
like some cool images, I wanted to focus on the faces because Jean-Pierre Jeunet like does a lot of like Dutch angle close-ups of faces and stuff that I find really intriguing.
Pure Frenchman for you.
The thing about the newborn is, you know, I had like five or six different pictures, and it looks different in each one. I think the model that they use, the design, is really incredible. Like,
oh, definitely.
Just the fact that it, like, at one angle it looks like an alien, another angle looks like a human face, you know, at certain angles it looks like a skeleton. Like, it's a marvelous design. I actually really love it. I know a lot of people don't.
It's cool look. Yeah.
I also think its death is brutal. Like,
sure just, is, like, man.
It's as close as you get, and I think this is maybe the intention of the film, to add some, literally and figuratively, some human elements to the alien for the first time.
Uh-huh.
But you really feel for that thing, man. Like, I don't care if it just crushed like a bunch of dudes' heads. Like, watching it die like that and seeing the look on his face is effective. Like, you really kind of go like, oh shit, man, that sucks. Like, you're just like, this is not pleasant, you know? And
No.
I thought that was effective. I thought that Sigourney Weaver, of course, sold it 100% that she could fuck an alien, but also like kind of be in love with this. This creature that she birthed, you know, like it's very interesting.
I want the deleted scene of Brad Dourif doing his running commentary while she's fucking the alien. Like,
I know that.
Over there. Yeah, up, get it. You know, like, just.
we got to talk about Brad.
His reappearance is like that. What a great little mic drop situation of like, oh no, he's still here, and look what he's doing now. Look what he's cheering on. Look what the investment, the transformation of stakes. That movie just hits another level of weirdness when he reappears, and that's worth it. You know, they've come that far.
Yeah, I love Brad Dourif in this. It's interesting because he's kind of on his own. He's kind of like the separate character in the movie. Like, he doesn't really interact with too many people. And yeah, he does very many Brad Dourif things in this.
He's professional creeper actor for sure.
Yeah, and he's not
leading rom coms anytime soon. Yeah.
Yeah, and I of course, you kind of get your mixture of Hicks/Hudson, you know, Bill Paxton mix up here with, I think Ron Perlman is fucking hilarious in this movie.
He's your beast linebacker, loose cannon, where like he's your Latimer from the program. You need one guy like that. Gary Durden coming in, and I know he became a TV star after this more than anything. Like, but like, I mean, he's got the. He went for the movie star. He's given the most movie star looks to himself. Like the guy who puts a crewmate on his back, has a big dramatic hero. Like he came out of nowhere. Cause like, he's like your third deep guy by the time Wincott and Perlman are in front of him from this crew. And he's got the cool, like obviously like pop out weapons and all that, but you don't expect him to like for a bit there, you know, put the heroism movie on his back literally and figuratively. So he's cool here. And then Wincott, of course, just Great kill. Well,
they give Wincott the Tom Skerritt treatment because he's totally introduced as kind of the captain of this pirate ship.
Yeah.
He's got his cool little voice. Like, he seems like he's in charge. Like, everyone respects him. Like, when he says to do things, everyone, I think the casting of this proto Firefly is excellent because they all really work together. And then he's like one of the first to die, and you're kind of like, oh bummer. Yeah. Like, he actually kind of like gets that treatment where you kind of are bummed that he's dead, because he's kind of a
I am for sure. Yeah,
he's kind of a cool character. I think that's the key. We're just talking about characters. I mean, this is, once again, this is another alien movie where the aliens really aren't, I mean, maybe the newborn is at the end, but the aliens really aren't the focus of this. This is about discovering new sides of Ripley. This is, I find the Winona Ryder, the mythology of it really fascinating, that this is like, she's a version of robots built by robots. So it's like the first time like maybe AI builds its own AI, you know, fascinating stuff there. And one thing I've always loved about all the Alien films, well, at least in the original four, because it never gets overburdened by its mythology. In fact, it actually kind of has an original Star Wars feel to it, in the sense of you just take what you have in front of you. They don't overexplain anything. You don't know the mechanics of how the military works. You don't know what life is like on other planets. I mean, the most you get from this movie is when they say, hey, we're going back to Earth. They're like, oh, fuck, I'd rather stay here with the aliens.
Yeah.
You know, or like, Earth, what a shithole. Like, even like in Alien 3, when they talk about that this used to be a Weyland-Yutani plant and now it's a prison, whatever, like, you're never given too much. And I like, there's like little scenes in this movie, like there's scenes where, like, which I think that was kind of brilliant, where the downtime, like on this military ship where they have nothing to do, and like in one scene, like they're just watching like QVC or something. There's no explanation as to where QVC is coming from, or why there's a TV station on here, why she's trying to drink coffee with boxing gloves. It's just, there's just kind of these quirky, not quirky, but there's just a lot of stuff that they don't go out of their way to explain. Like, you don't need to know how the military was formed. You don't need to go back to Earth and have somebody in a business suit going, we need the aliens. Like, it's just,
They
present you with stuff. Nothing is over-explained. And that's probably why Prometheus sucks, because everything is explained at that point.
That's true.
But
no, this movie, I think you use the word subversive more for the bigger themes, but like when it comes to the character side, shifty. Like, you, any of these characters on a dime could be a hero or a villain, even Hedaya. Yeah. And this, obviously the scientists really show themselves to be pretty despicable, but then even with Ripley being like, she could just take this movie over and fuck people up if she wanted to. So they even apply some of that shiftiness to her, where like, could she be a villainess, you know, or just take this too far, or side with the aliens, and now she's a threat and an issue for our humans to get away from. Like, I like how the movie keeps those things gray and out of reach for most of the movie. So,
yeah, I misquoted it. I thought it was a summer film. I guess you said it was Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah, no, I looked it up. November, Thanksgiving weekend, 97, okay. Yeah.
Well, regardless, I still think the swings this movie takes for a big budget release
is exceptional. Yeah, I mean, you're still talking about a holiday hitter where, you know, you're supposed to put your Oscar bait, you know, family film stuff on Thanksgiving weekend, or as if you would in a summer weekend. So, the swings are still made to mess with people in a time where you're not used to getting messed with.
Yeah, and even as a younger viewer, you know, I mean, I would like to say I started watching complex things or whatever when I was 15 or 16 or whatever. But even maybe when I wasn't picking up on some of these deeper emotional themes or things like that, the movie itself, I mean, has some incredible sequences. Like, I think the underwater sequence is just fucking astounding. Oh, like, that is such a great sequence. I mean,
it's preposterous, because there's like 4 minute breath holds going on there. Everyone's blowing out bubbles and exasperating, but we're still down underwater and making it through some cuts.
To show you how great filmmaking was, and we talked in the last episode about how we miss documentaries.
Yeah.
The documentary for this, the making of, is pretty extensive. I'd say almost 2 hours, maybe an hour and a half, something like that. These actors were all underwater, and they would film takes. They would film their takes, and then someone in a scuba suit would come over and give them air, and they would just stay underwater all day and film. So it has that realism to it. Yes, it's a very CGI alien swimming in the water, but the fact that the real people are actually in the water doing this, reacting, some of them actually running out of breath, you know, like it's really impressive. And a lot of the action in this is quite impressive. That underwater sequence is great. Another behind the scenes story I love to just tell anybody because, I'm a nerd like this, but, and you gotta credit the editor on this movie because they were able to get the shot because they show the uncut version in the behind the scenes. But in that scene where Ripley shoots the basketball behind her head, she made it.
I heard about this. Yeah,
and at that point they had a second camera on Ron Perlman, and he turns around to look at her, and he immediately starts to laugh because he's like, "Holy shit, she made it!" Like out of character. In the final cut, you can't tell, but if you've seen the raw footage, which they show in the documentary, he turns and then breaks out of character so fast. The fact that they were able to edit it and get it is just one of those things when I watch it now where I'm always looking to see if I can find the crease where like maybe you can see him just start smiling or something. But crisply edited, really made the shot. They show her making the shot on the behind the scenes. Just kind of a cool little...
Oh, yeah.
Of course, Sigourney Weaver is going to make the half court behind the back shot, you know, but it's kind of fun stuff you don't get on behind the scenes documentaries anymore where you get to see raw footage of reactions to things. But there's just a lot of great, fun things going on in this movie. Now, you did mention that you thought some of it was stupid. What do you think is stupid? I'm not being like critical. I'm just curious. Like, what do you think is stupid about it?
Some of the ragtag crew guy stuff is dialed up a little. And now that I know it's Whedon, I didn't know who Joss Whedon was in 97. I do know him now. I don't give a shit about any of the problematic Joss Whedon stuff. He made a movie back then and it worked. But no, like some of the crew stuff, like there's just some happy-go-lucky, just like our wheelchair guy should be dead in 4 seconds. Gary Durdan gets away with some unlikely heroism here or there. Like it just gets a little silly and dumb. Dan Hedaya is one of those guys where you can't put him in space. I watch him and he's fun. You know, I want to see him, you know, lose his shit a little bit, but, I guess another thing that would be dumb for me at this point, four movies in, would be, we're still here 200 years later trying to weaponize, put laser beams on the raptors' heads like Jurassic World or something. Like we're still trying to like capture and weaponize these aliens. Like we're still on that, you know, like four movies in, like get something else. I just the scientific angle we've seen 1,000 times at this point where I'm, or at least three good times where I needed a different nefarious motivator than that. I like the Ripley. I like the clone stuff. I mean, I know if that's where you're going, you're going to experiment in the aliens too. I get it, but have something different than putting sharks with laser beams on their heads, or at least the attempt to get them in that direction.
But here's the thing, though. Like, just to counter that a little bit, like,
sure.
We only get in the first one a message saying bring it back so we can look at it. The second one, the whole plot hinges on the fact that this colony was eaten up by them, and then the company wants them. And then in three, it's at the end when the company comes in and says, we want them. Yeah. I don't think we've seen the sharks with laser beam part yet, though.
No, you know what I mean? That's the thing. They've lost 3 times. They've never been able to capture one. So,
right. And
I think they're still going to that well. You know what I mean?
I know, but I think some of that with the clone thing and the fact that they are smuggling these humans in, they figured out a way to kind of the fact that they figured out a way to kind of mechanize breeding them, like the fact that if we capture some people in hypersleep and then we bring them in here and then we put their faces in front of the thing, and like they seem to know now how the process works, you know, like there's some kind of organization to it. And the fact that Ripley exists, even though it took 7 tries,
right,
or he tries, is kind of a indicator that they might have something. I mean, yes, it is a kind of worn thing, but I think that this franchise hasn't exploited. Like, I would get, I would see your point of view if in the third Alien there was a bunch of aliens running around, you know, that had, you know, human scent or whatever, some bullshit that like they were mechanized, and then, but we haven't seen that, and I think that, and we also know, in real life that profit comes above everything else. So if you can waste a bunch of money on research and development on a bunch of bullshit that can possibly help you take over somebody else.
The bullshit science does bring the child alien, the human amalgamation one. Like we get to a cool part of something unique and different for compared to other things. So we get through their time fuckery, we do get to something fun. It's just still.
I get you.
This also could be, and maybe this is a special edition thing. This is probably. We take a good bit of time in the beginning. Like this is that first, almost like Alien 3, that first 40 minutes can be a little bit like, okay, when we get into business here, like, I don't get me wrong, I'll watch Michael Wincott, you know, wheel and deal with Dan Hedaya for a little bit, but like, that's a 7 minute scene that could be five. Like I could trim
the theatrical cut though. That's in the theatrical cut.
Trim and get to business a little quicker. Just a
tell me, because I watched this on Hulu. I watched the theatrical cut. I from my quadrilogy days, the director's cut / special edition wasn't.
Let me see if I can just hear. Yeah,
it wasn't
not like a lot.
So it was there wasn't a lot. So I don't unlike
not like, other directors. Not like three, cuts, right?
Yeah, I'll watch whatever one is on, you know? So I actually don't remember, other than the opening sequence where there's like a dude in space that like squashes a bug or something.
Yeah.
What are some of the differences?
That's the part I got for sure.
Yeah. What are
some of the differences? Let me see if I can look this up here a little bit. Future director's cut. I got to look this up in a different spot here. I think it was the, I think they did some more with director's cut. I still can't find it. I'm looking in the wrong place. I think they do a little more with, It is. It might be like 6 or 7 minutes total. Maybe some of it. Oh, there's like an additional, additional crew stuff, especially with Call. Something else with, who's the other character I'm trying to get here? No, not so much Christy, because that's Durdan. I think they give a little more to Leland Orser, and that's fine, because Leland Orser plays the best freakout weirdo in cinema history. Because between this and Seven, he's a professional losing his shit on screen.
Yep.
Director's cut. I can't find it.
That's all right.
Can't be too bad here. Yeah.
It's not like Alien 3 that added what like 30 minutes.
That was a lot. Whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
It was negligible to me to the point where I can watch either version and I don't think I'm missing out on anything. I guess.
Right.
My point. I saw it in the theater.
I found it here. You keep going. All right. Yeah.
No, go ahead. I'd love to.
Deleted scenes include, here we go. The deleted scenes include references to the character Newt from Aliens, Vreese making a joke to Call, Ripley's clone waking up in the middle of her operation, an extended conversation between Perez and Elgin, which is the Hedaya Wincott stuff. Extended conversation in the mess hall that reveals the eventual fate of Ripley's former employers, Weyland Yutani. An extended dialogue between Call and Ripley's clone in the chapel and scenes of the Betty landing on Earth and the planet's landscape during the final dialogue between Ripley and Call as they view the ruins of Paris. The special edition restored 13 minutes and 5 seconds worth of footage, but in doing so, it's only 7 minutes longer than the theatrical version. So little stuff. You're right. Little stuff.
But I do remember now that ending. That's actually one... every now and then there's a director's cut that I actually will avoid. Like for one of those for me is Army of Darkness, the director's cut. I don't like the ending of that. And this one, I did not like the ending, the director's cut. I don't like them on Earth at all. I think
I agree. I never come there.
It's a weird, it just feels weird. I like the idea. I like that the movie ends in the theatrical cut. So I don't know how long you've seen the theatrical cut, but
since 97. Yeah.
Yeah. So the theatrical cut, the way it ends is, they've just, you know, kicked the shit out of the, the alien sucked it out of the hole.
Right.
And correct me if I'm wrong. I can't remember something. Oh, yeah, yeah. They end up going through the atmosphere or whatever. It's hard to
remember. Yeah, yeah.
But instead of like them landing like they do in the director's cut, like they're just flying over the sea or whatever.
Okay.
Like they're really high. Like you can see Earth, but they're like
super
high.
Yeah.
And Call says something along the lines of, oh, it looks so beautiful. And she says something, I can't remember what she says, but then Sigourney Weaver says something to the likes of, I'm a new visitor here myself. Like I'm new.
Yeah. That line's still here.
Yeah. And that's how the movie ends in the theatrical. Uh-huh. So it's kind of a nice like thing where like, you don't see her on Earth. You can only imagine in your head canon what it's like for Ripley, who's not really Ripley, to mm-hmm. go back to Earth. You know, it's kind of a neat little ending that I enjoy. And like I said, I really wish I got to see more of this Ripley. I think that
I agree. This is a fun version of her.
She's really fascinating. A lot of stuff you can mine there from the emotions and her dealing with that inner turmoil of being two things at once. And just a lot of stuff there. I think I know the movie made money. But I think it bombed.
Yeah. So
I don't know if it bombed. I don't think it bombed. Oh,
this one counts as a bomb. So it was budgeted at 75, made 45 domestic. It was bounced out in 4 weeks, which is most things in 97 last 2 months. So it made only 16 million in second place its first weekend, stayed post Thanksgiving in second place, but dropped 60%. And they gave it 2 more weeks where by the time it was in 11th place, it was out of theaters. Right in time for Titanic to sweep everything. So
domestically, yes, but this had a huge international presence.
Yes, I think it definitely
made its money because not only do you have a French director, but I think this kind of weird shit really flies in Europe.
I'm with you there. Like it did well there. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think overall it lost money, but yeah, in the U.S. it was definitely a disappointment for sure. Mm-hmm. And even if it wasn't, even if it made all that money from the international box office on top of it, I think it ended up making like close to $200 million overall, I think.
Probably. I'm just scrolling down, look this up. Sounds like the fan fiction of this film has kept going too. Like this is the place that original stories have kept going because once you get to Versus Predator, no one wants to associate with the rest of the lore, so to speak.
Hate those fucking movies. I think despite the fact that maybe it did make money in the end, internationally combined, you know, the worldwide total.
Yeah.
The reviews were pretty bad. So I think it definitely kind of killed the franchise. Cause at this point, the way they were looking at it is even though Alien 3 made money also, reviews weren't great and reviews weren't great for this. I think people were kind of like, okay, this is not going the way we want. We're going to have to reshuffle and redouble our efforts. And unfortunately, they redoubled it with Alien vs. Predator, which I'm sure made money, but is definitely not reaching the creative heights of this one. I guess my point with this is, and the reason why I love this movie too, and I've found a new love for it rewatching it again for the first time, maybe a couple of years, is everything everybody complains about is in this movie. Like it is.
You're right.
Is solved with this movie. This movie takes all the risks. It has all the directorial flourishes that people want from studio films that quote unquote don't exist. It takes risks. There's actual stakes. Characters die. Like it's a quote unquote beloved franchise that is willing to play with its format, play with its characters, play with its mythology, not explain too much. It just does all the things franchise filmmaking doesn't do anymore. Studio filmmaking really doesn't do anymore.
I agree.
And so I actually think if this was released today, let's throw out the technology part of it because unfortunately, this is just the way of it. This would be a completely CGI green screen movie. That's just the way
it is. Oh, yeah. You get some initial set design of dirty spaces. We always do in these things, but everything else would get a whole lot of CGI. Right. Yeah.
So, but let's pretend in this fantasy world that this movie was made just as it is just as it was in 97 today. Okay.
Yeah.
Practical effects, same sense of humor, you know, directorial flourishes, stuff like this. I think this would be heralded today. I think this would be considered, I really honestly think it would, because people would say like, man, it doesn't do any of the stuff that the movies do these days. I think people would look at it as this bold, risk-taking, I don't think it'd make any money, but it would, critic-wise, people would say, wow, what a bold, risk-taking movie.
I think that's a good question. Like, well, I'm going to put the Whedon stuff aside. Like, it would get canceled today. Does it, like, I hate to, like, start checking boxes of what people, especially critics who think of higher brow cinema than they really ever need to when it comes to genre films. Like, would they need this to be, I don't mean to say it like this, but, like, would they need this to be more LGBTQ? Like, can you
twist Ripley?
It is, but like, can you, but they're going to want that dial a little hotter, you know, like, or like a little more authoritative, or like, they're going to want that stamped further than it is with just innuendo and basketball fucking jokes. You're going to need, what else are you going to need in this movie? I don't know. It's today. I want to hope what you hope, that that it's subversive enough and challenging enough to be out of the box that people are like, wow, look at them really do something here. And and if this was like a long lost legacy sequel kind of thing, and like in that framework of things, like, especially compared to what Ridley's doing over with the prequel junk, that would this stand out, or this just be wild and crazy? Is there a space for wild and crazy? I'm torn. I can see it being eyebrow. People roll their eyes, and then I can see people going, "Hey, man, that movie's got some fucking balls. It's crazy enough to work." And
well, yeah, it's
tough
hard
one. Tough one.
It's also hard to, in this fictional scenario. I mean, this is a, like you said, Titanic is about to come out when this come out.
Oh, I know.
When this came out, and movies are so different now. So it is hard. So it's kind of hard to say, like,
but I can't call this movie I can't call this movie a time capsule or product of its time.
No,
it's
not at all.
Other than some not great effects, it's not all that 1997, like, where like Winona Ryder's haircut doesn't make it look dated or anything going on with casting. Like, you could put this movie, like you said, now, and people wouldn't bat an eye.
Yeah.
So it's not like watching an 80s movie that can't get out of the 80s, you know?
It's why I think I can rewatch it so much, as it has,
I think you're right,
modern sensibilities to it. I think it's an easier film to watch. I mean, as much as you and I are film buffs and we watch things from the past, there is something about a certain era of films that are easily digestible.
That's the 90s, for sure.
Something happens at some point in time when a movie just looks a certain way, and has kind of always looked that way, even though the technology might have changed, but just the way the language of movies is kind of...
Yeah,
I agree. There's a certain cutoff point where it's like, you can throw this on... It might be around that 97 time, really, where you can just kind of throw it on and not... Like I said, I watched this the other day. I mean, other than a few scenes of visual effects that are clearly the early days of CGI, you know, because I would say anything from 91 to 98 is kind of when they're feeling shit out.
Right, right.
This could have come out today. And in fact, it has definitely. It looks great. It's a super stylish movie. It's the cinematography is fantastic. It looks really good. Like, it doesn't feel...
Yeah. That would help it today, is the sharp look of it. Yeah.
That's what hinders Alien 3 a little bit, but actually helps this movie, because I think I'd be able to show this to, like, my kids. Oh, I'm not going to show it to my kids because
you heard it here first, kid.
Yeah. You know what I mean? But you know what I mean? Like, I could probably show this one, like, to a group of younger people, and they would be less, like, burdened by the look or the whatever. I think this one is probably the most accessible.
I think so.
Enough, because it's also the fucking weirdest one.
Well, weirdest one, most violent one, like, the body counts up, like, it's... Yeah,
a lot of gore.
Oh yeah,
a lot of.
With that, maybe that's the other thing that wouldn't play well today is like, other than Ari Aster and we don't get a lot of like hard R horror anymore. Like we've been doing the Megan PG-13 stuff, Cocaine Bear. Like we've been going very weirdly PG-13. Where is this too gory for people today? Which is weird to say. Or are we desensitized where we look at it and go, I've seen stuff go through chests before. And
No. I will actually go with you on this one because even me, I'm not special or anything, but there were definitely a few things in this movie where I was like, I crunched my face a little bit. Like I was there's some pretty visceral stuff in this one. I mean, it's, I'll always remember, it's always stuck with me, but when like Dan Hedaya gets punched in the back of the head by the thing and he pulls out like a piece of his brain and looks at it like, but like the way like the newborn like smashes people's heads and stuff, it's pretty, it's a pretty, pretty gruesome movie. But I also love the fact, despite how graphic it is and how gory it can be, there are some great moments of subtlety too. Like when, the alien gets into the escape pod and all you see is like the blood hitting the windows, like just the stuff going through your head. Like what the fuck is going on in there?
Well, like, the other thing is the, when we're watching these things you're describing, that's the difference from then to now is all of that blood and gore stuff is still done with really good makeup and practical effects, where today the CGI spray of things makes things feel less visceral. Like tar for CGI gore to, you can turn the dial and make it as excessive as you want, but it doesn't feel as tangible as when it's like you said, spraying windows and people and sticking on actors, and you know it muddies up with other fluids and things in the scene, and because you still got the alien KY jelly thing going on, where like all of that is a slew of a mix of a milieu of nastiness that is tangible. We don't have that nowadays, where this would be, maybe that's another place where this would stand out. Is like, holy fuck, this is a dirty movie, you know? And it's not, because CGI blood just can't do that. We can make things look really gross and really crazy, but that doesn't mean we look at it and go, that's so unbelievable, I can't believe it. Whereas this stuff, like, we're watching heads and guys and people fucking coughing up blood, and like even Wincott's death, like, oh damn, you know? And yeah, like Wincott, you said, the brain matter comes out.
That's a tough one. Like when he gets like freaking.
Oh yeah,
he gets a pretty brutal death in this one. I don't know. It's definitely a weird one. It's definitely one that I understand why people have their issues. I don't know if it just hit me at the right time.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's a nostalgia thing. I don't know if it's just my type of filmmaking. I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, I love it, and I always will love it, and I loved it even more watching it now. So I will always be one of the defenders for this movie. I just adore it. I love it.
You have now recruited a new fellow defender, because like that, same thing. I would rewatch this one before others because it's just fun, but it's fun without we've got the wisecracker jokes. We have some, but not a lot. Like it's not all jokes all the time. Like Ripley does the "Who do I have to fuck around here?" thing. Like it's 50% of the jokes that are in today's movies, and twice as much of the brutality that's in today's movies. And that balance, or that imbalance, I guess I should say, it serves it well versus just low stakes of today. Well, like this movie still has so much more balls than everything else.
There's a lot of stuff I still quote from that movie. I talked to one of them off the air, but like when Ron Perlman was like, "Hey, Ripley's back," but also like "You never fucked a robot." That's one of my favorite. That's one of my favorite lines. Like, for some reason, sometimes I'll just say that. Like, and if anyone hears it, they're probably like, "What?" But I just love the delivery of it, and it's just kind of perfect. And like, I think there's another one where Ron Perlman's like, "I'll get you off, but it won't be off the ship." Like, what the fuck? This is stupid. But it's it's just enjoyable. It's quotable. It's fun. Blah, blah, blah. It's a good one. I'm glad I recruited you to the side, the good side.
You betcha.
Of this
All right, sir. Wrap this up until someday we get to Prometheus.
Oh, God. Okay.
I know.
Well, I enjoyed this, the four we talked about so far. Uh-huh. All right, folks, we now have merch from shirts to stickers. Find some sweet cinephile hissy fit swag on tpublic.com/users/ruminationsradio network. Follow us on Twitter at Cinephile Fit, on Facebook at Cinephile Hissy Fit Podcast, and Instagram at Cinephile Fits. Find both of us by name on Letterboxd to check out our film reviews and ratings. We are also on Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you so much for your loyal listenership and our tussles and for connecting with us on social media. Cinephile Hissy Fit is a Ruminations Radio Network podcast sponsored by Film Obsessive. If you enjoyed this show, the Ruminations Radio Network has more excellent programming, stellar hosts, and spirited topics. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our show and others on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere, including Earth. What a shithole. You find your favorite podcasts.